audio, I apologize. For the record, we are calling the meeting to order. We will start out with a discussion on, we will open an informational meeting, and we will start with a discussion on processors, and we will be led off by Mr. Tom Burns from the OLCC. Welcome.
Co-chairs and members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Marijuana Programs for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Processors. Processors is one of four licenses envisioned in Measure 91. It is probably the broadest and most comprehensive of the four licenses. A processor can make extracts. A processor can be a kitchen that makes edibles. A processor may be a plant of some sort that makes products such as salves and lotions. A processor is something that is a company that packages marijuana. A processor is something that labels marijuana. It is, in short, the broadest of all of the licenses that exist under Measure 91. A processor may not be a grower, although obviously they can hold the same, the company or the individual can hold both licenses. A processor may only sell down the food chain, that is, they could sell to another processor, such as an extract maker could sell to a kitchen, or the processor could sell to a wholesaler or to a retail establishment. They cannot sell up to a grower. A processor gets all of their product from the grower. To make extracts, but as I said, a processor could take an extract to sell it to a kitchen to make an edible that would then move on down the chain. So let me sort of break these broad categories into unique pieces. Extracts. Extract is a process by which you take the leaf of the marijuana plant and you treat it with some solvent. Sometimes that solvent is propane or butane or CO2, or it can be water, or it can be vegetable glycerin, or any one of the other alcohol, for example, that is out there in the market today. That process extracts the THC from the leaf. The leaf is then thrown away, and the concentrate is available for use either by the consumer directly or by other manufacturers. There is a risk with processors or extract makers. In the old days, this was called Rick Simpson oil. It was made by taking butane and heating it. Butane is something that tends to explode if you get it to the wrong temperature, and you have seen in the press a number of people who have tried to make an extract and have it blown up on them, and they've taken both their lives and their facilities at risk. One of the things that we think is very important is that, therefore, that all processors who make extract must do it in a closed-loop system. The people who are smarter than me can detail that, but what that essentially means is that the solvent is that is extracting the THC stays inside the system and can't leak. Extracts will need to be tested. Whether they test the raw product or not, I think should be a decision made by them, but the resulting product will need to be tested, if only to assure that the solvents that are used are not left in the product and therefore moving on to the consumers. They will need to do some sort of label, and what that label exactly looks like is something that we still are needing to build. There's then the kitchens. The kitchens are the ones who make edibles. They need to be licensed as a kitchen. I use the term commercial kitchen. You have the Oregon Department of Agriculture in the room. They are the ones that license these kitchens. They will tell you that the commercial kitchen is not quite right, but that's the way I think of it, as opposed to a retail kitchen where you go into a restaurant and order food from a restaurant. That's licensed by public health. But kitchens that sell a product to the consumer who walks out the door with it are licensed by ODA. Again, they will take the extract, they will do whatever they do with the extract to make the edible, and the finished product will need to be tested for potency, as well as it will need to be tested for whether the underlying product, the brownie itself, is in fact safe. And obviously there are standards by which food products need to have certain labeling on, and we will require that labeling. A product is a salve or an ointment or something that has THC in it. I believe that they are made, although this is an area that I don't fully understand, I believe they are made in commercial kitchens as well, and those kitchens would need to be licensed by ODA. Again, they would need to be tested for potency, and whatever the underlying lotion is, to make sure that that is safe and it is appropriately labeled. And then finally, we have the whole issue of packaging. The way Measure 91 is written, it says that if you want to package marijuana, you must have a processor license. That opens the question up of whether a retailer who wants to buy 1 pound of bud and convert that into 16 one-ounce pre-packages, do they need a processor license? We believe they currently do, and the question is whether that is an appropriate requirement if all you're doing is packaging for pre-sale. That's something that is a policy question that can be addressed either by you or left to us by rule. Because the license is so broad, we are looking at either putting specific endorsements on that license. That is, if you want to be a kitchen, you need to get a kitchen endorsement. If you want to be an extract maker, you need to get an extract endorsement, or coming to you and asking you to break that license up into multiple licenses so that we can look at each of the unique areas by itself and build rules and processes that govern each of those unique areas. At that, I will stop and come back later and talk to you about edibles when we get to that subject. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you for that introduction. That was very succinct. So you said that if a processor can sell to a kitchen, but they're under the same license. How does that work?
Co-chair Senator Burdick, it is possible that somebody only wants to make brownies and does not want to make the extract. And so you have an extract maker who's very good at making extract. He knows how to make extract. He sells that extract to the kitchen for the kitchen to make the brownie. Or it is possible that both of those physically exist inside the same space, which obviously raises questions about, you know, how you separate the kitchen, which makes things that we eat, from the solvents that are used to make the extract. And that is something that if it is the same physical space, we have to figure out how to put walls in place or assure that there's no contaminants to move from one side of that to the other.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Tom, it's interesting because when we get into inspections and what is Health Department and what is ODA, I have a kitchen at my farm market. It is inspected by ODA. If I put in 12 chairs for people to sit down, then it becomes inspection by the Health Department, okay? The point of that is we have too many different strings running too many different places in inspection. We've talked about that in a broader scale for a long time. I'm wondering if we might consider simplifying to where some way for one inspection to cover the universe. It would take legislation to do that. But, you know, I mean, I could even go into nursing homes where they have five different agencies go in to inspect five different things instead of doing it all at once. So, I mean, it's a bigger concept, but I think for simplification, we might want to consider some way where we can have one-stop shopping and not go multiple agencies on this stuff.
Co-Chair Senator Cruz, both the OHA, which is a public health agency, and ODA are in the audience, so you might want to ask that question of them. I understand there's an agreement between them that defines your 12 chair example to decide which side gets it, but that's from OLCC's perspective, we don't really care. Somebody else should decide that the kitchen is safe so that the product that is made can be safely consumed. We would then license them to handle the marijuana side of it.
Yeah, I guess, Madam Chair, and I understand that. I'm just thinking maybe we need to take a different look at this whole thing and see if maybe we can design a better, simpler system. Just a thought.
This is called mission creep, Senator Cruz. other questions from the committee? Thank you. Yes, please. Representative Leininger.
So I want to acknowledge that over the course of this last number of meetings, people have come from really long distances to be here and listen in or offer your testimony. And a number of us had the pleasure of going to Williams, Oregon, before the beginning of session for just an unofficial fact-finding mission. And I know that some of our friends from Williams have driven all the way up here for today to kind of witness and hear how things are going with this committee. And so without singling out anyone, I just want to say welcome to folks who've come a long way. Thank you for your input. Welcome and thanks to the people who haven't come a long way but who keep coming back. It's an important process, and we really value your participation. So thanks.
Thank you for that, Representative Leiner. Okay, our next two witnesses, actually we'll bring all three up, Karen Sprague, Norris Monson, and Don Morris. Why don't we start with Ms. Sprague and go to Mr. Monson and then Mr. Morris. Okay.
Welcome.
And if you'd identify yourself for the record, that'd be great.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Karen Sprague, and I'm from Southern Oregon. And I really appreciate you listening to the testimony from the people in the community. It means a lot to us. And we trust that you have the education and the wherewithal to make the right decisions for us in Oregon, so I appreciate that. I'm a Southern Oregon resident. And my partners and I have launched an extract company called the CO2 Company. This provides medicine and patient to patients and dispensaries. And I've been an Oregon resident for 24 years. And I'm a patient and also a grower of the OMMP program since about 2006. I grew for myself and a couple of other patients. And I started working with the patients and their needs. I experimented making lotions and salves and edibles and concentrates. The community began to reach out and ask me for certain products for certain ailments along the way. People would call and they knew that I was experimenting and educating myself in the realm of medical marijuana and making products. So I started helping people that had ailments of cancer, you know, that wanted to experiment. And I gave medicine to an RSO provider, and he gave the medicine to the patients. And so that's my history a little bit. And then I was going to talk to you about the CO2 extraction that we use right now. We use a supercritical high pressure and temperatures to extract the medicine. And the medicine has, the machine has a built-in safety mechanism for us that provides or prevents accidents with high pressure system. It will actually shut itself down internally if it signals the built-in parameters. Furthermore, we have hired safety consultants to help with SOPs for a safe workspace for our people and for our products. Let's see. In conclusion, I would like to thank you for listening to us and for letting us be part of this. And I would open to any questions that anybody might have for me.
Thank you. We'll wait on questions until the whole panel has talked. So, Mr. Monson.
Thank you, co-chairs Burdick and Leninger and committee members. My name is Norris Monson. I am a resident of Portland, Oregon. I am a cannabis cultivator and extractor. I currently have a facility where we produce CO2 extracted oil as well as hydrocarbon extracted oil. We do so using closed, as Tom mentioned earlier, we use closed loop systems, which means that the gas that we use to produce the solvent or the extracts is recovered at the end of the process. It's not released into the atmosphere. We have implemented a number of safety practices in our facility that we think, along with others, should probably be implemented. We currently have spark-free environments for our hydrocarbon areas. We have spark-free fans. Spark-free lighting fixtures, grounded machinery, everything is professionally made, and Sorry, I didn't have time to prepare testimony today. Currently, looking at the landscape in Oregon, there are a lot of producers that are open producing butane extracts and causing a lot of problems in the news. You've probably seen people blowing up apartments, cars, bathrooms, and other public places. We believe that this can be prevented by just implementing simple safety protocols that regulate this process. We think that we should be regulated using whatever the state believes, in conjunction with the industry folks, engineers, and others, should be implemented. We currently do our best to follow the safety guidelines as we understand them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And now, Mr. Morse.
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leninger, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to speak tonight. My name is Donald Morse, and I'm the owner of Sia Green Processors, co-owner of the Human Collective Dispensary, and chair of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. I'm here to speak of the need to license the manufacturing of all processors of marijuana. The processing of cannabis is the act of taking raw plant material, which has been tested for mold, mildew, and pesticides, and stripping it of its trichomes to produce a concentrated form of marijuana. The stripping of the trichomes can be done with oil, glycerin, or butter, and these concentrates are more often what end up being used in edible products. Stripping trichomes is also done with various solvents such as butane, propane, alcohol, and CO2. The concentrates resulting from this form of separation produce items known as wax, shatter, crumble, RSO, and oils. In most cases, the oils are used in vape pens, cartridges, and what are called drippers. All of the above is done without any rules or oversight. As you all know, Measure 91 speaks of licenses for various sectors of our industry, processors being one of them. We need a license for processing so we can establish a level playing field for all processors, as well as strong public safety measures. And in other words, we need to stop blowing ourselves up. When you read in the newspaper about a garage blowing up or a house catching fire, it is because the occupants who were processing marijuana were processing a concentrate without a closed loop system. Things like closed loop systems, fire suppression equipment, and proper HVAC are needed to ensure worker safety as well as public safety. A closed loop system, for example, will contain the solvents being used, whereas an open loop system allows the gases to escape, which can easily result in an explosion. Because of these dangers, I would encourage the committee to consider an annual inspection by local fire marshal and specific zoning for processors with hazardous chemicals. All concentrates should have to undergo testing for pesticides, mold, mildew, and residual solvents to ensure product quality in the marketplace. Some feel these tests are redundant. However, any pesticides that may have passed in the initial testing quite possibly could manifest in hazardous quantities after having been concentrated. Rules for packaging and labeling of the end product are necessary. Packaging options range from silicone and acrylic containers to plastic syringes and glass tubes. Regardless of which options are used, these items should be placed in some sort of childproof, resealable packaging and proper with proper labeling. The amount of THC and CBD should be clearly marked on the manufacturer's label, as well as the name of the lab that did the testing. No item should ever be packaged or marketed in a manner that would be of interest to a child. The potency of concentrates can run from 30% to almost 90% THC or CBD, depending on the quality of the plant material and the type of solvent used to extract the trichomes. Some have suggested that higher amounts of THC are beyond what is necessary for the retail market. Should this committee entertain the need for some sort of cap on the retail market, it is critically important that medical patients have the ability to access higher level amounts to maintain their treatments. We ask of these things that these things be done because the industry does not have a level playing field and needs one. As you may know, some members of the industry, such as Norris here, in this sector have stepped up to lead the way by joining the Oregon Cannabis Business Council and helping to shape this proposed policy. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, and all three of you, I invite you to submit your testimony for our record. I saw that you had prepared remarks. Maybe you're ready to roll on that, and anything that other two would like to present, we'd love to have on your testimony. So are there questions from the committee? Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I want to kind of go through the processing of closed loop, open loop, and then specifically about some of the different extractions. Regarding CO2 extraction, what type of residue, if any, is on the material once the extraction has taken place?
I can speak to what I know of that. I've asked those questions, and they said that there's no residue from the CO2.
All right.
Are you speaking specifically about residue from CO2?
Or? Yes. Okay, I'm going to go into the next as to the Thames, because that's where I have some issues as to what I've heard. And I know for the reasons why we'd want to be having that testing and for that. But I'm just trying, I'm not familiar with the CO2 extraction process.
Generally, people are going to test concentrates for butane, propane, and other solvents. CO2 is recognized as harmless. I don't think a lot of people actually have tested to determine it. So I don't know. There may be CO2, but if it is, it is likely. It's beverage grade at worst. You know,
right.
Operators operate using and safe for consumption.
Sorry.
I'll bring the mic a little closer to you. Great. Thank you.
Follow up,
please.
So then on the Thames, walk us through that, because that's some of the stuff I'm hearing is I know that a lot of people say you have to use Thames, such as butane, to actually be able to get certain type of extractions or level of extraction. And I'm really concerned, or not concerned, I'm curious as to whether that is, how much merit is there as compared to using CO2, alcohol, or what other types of let's say, solvents that could be used that may not have those same issues.
I don't know about the Thames.
So concentrates produced with whether it's alcohol, propane, butane, any solvent, are likely to have some residual solvent in the finished product.
Okay.
So in depending on the state that you're in, most states, Colorado, Washington, they're regulating the amount of residual solvents that's permissible in the finished product. That number could be 500 parts per million. It's going to be expressed in parts per million, just like a lot of other things. That number could be 500. It could be 50 parts per million. But there's going to be a number assigned. While, you know, I'm not a doctor, I can't speak for the health effects of a little bit of residual butane. One of the things that I've heard from a very reputable testing lab from California is that the, you know, permissible levels in California generally are accepted at 500. The act of lighting a cigarette or a pipe with cannabis in it probably gives you about 800 parts per million of residual solvent by inhaling that. So it is a concern, should be addressed. How big of a concern, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for Mr. Munson, and you were kind enough to host several of us at your facility at the end of the year. My question is, you have your machines are very industrial strength and size, and you also have a grow operation adjacent. My observation was that you're located both in an industrial zone and in an industrial building. Could you tell us just a little bit about any challenges you've faced in living next door to your neighbors who have other industrial uses, I would imagine? And are there any challenges for them to have you located there?
So in my situation, I think it's some of it is going to be dependent on the location you're in and just people's views on this issue. Everybody, you know, I'm sure all of you, sorry, and I should be saying co-chairs.
Norris,
could you move
the microphone a little closer
there? But everybody's got a different perspective on it. I live in Multnomah County. My facility is in Multnomah County. Most people's, if you saw what happened with 91, a very large percentage of people in my county voted yes on this. So my neighbors, they're aware of what we do. They're not concerned or worried about it at all, but in other locales, you might have neighbors that are worried about it. A lot of the amount of actual solvent at my facility as compared to other facilities processing other items is not not very large. You know, if you're a welder, you've got gas and oxygen right there, which if that was to explode would be very dangerous. So in terms of my neighbors and my challenges, I haven't had them. I would think what is going to happen going forward is fire marshals are going to get involved more. You're going to have building codes, and you're going to have a lot of just the day-to-day things that, as Senator Cruz pointed out in his restaurant, you're going to have different departments coming, or farmers market, you're going to have different departments coming out to inspect with different concerns, not all the same. So I think that's really going to be the challenge, is meeting the muster of what the fire marshal would like to see, what your local municipalities has in terms of what they want you to do versus your neighbors, because ultimately it's the state that gets to decide what we're going to be doing. So
one follow-up. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Any environmental problems like air quality inputs or outputs, odors, dust?
You know, in terms of the processing, the dust is pretty minimal. Growing, there's no real dust. Odor, this is something that I've had a number of people through my facility, and I've heard different ends of the continuum. One end of the continuum is people are complaining about the smell. This is great. The other end is, oh my God, I can't stand that. Get that away from me. So the odor issue, is it a health hazard? I really don't know that there's any science that would say that this is a fact. Might it annoy some people? Yeah, I think that's quite possible. There are methods you can take to mitigate that through using carbon filters and negative pressure to draw air. Imagine if you have a room with a stinky substance in it. You draw all the air through a fixed area, make sure all the air is coming through cracks and not as controlled exit, basically. So you can mitigate this. And, yeah, you can mitigate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Mr. Morse, would you tell us what the Oregon Cannabis Business Council is? Who are your members, and what how we can work together on this issue?
Well, we're a trade association for the industry, and we represent testing labs, processors, medical.
Let me get the microphone over.
Medical manufacturers and dispensaries. We also have some growers now as well. And we're just a growing community of people who would like to see the industry develop in a logical and proper way with proper legislation and oversight for our various sectors.
And is your organization mostly interested in getting into the recreational side, or do you have medical representation as well?
Both. I mean, right now, of course, everything is based on the medical program, but a lot of our members do want to move into the retail side as it develops. That's why we're here.
Okay. And is it fair to say that your comments about wanting a level playing field and effective regulation are shared by your membership?
Yes. I think that's a very important thing. I think Norris would agree it's very detrimental to the industry when there are people out there cutting corners and blowing themselves up or whatever, when the industry goes through great pains and expense to try and do what they do in a safe and socially responsible manner. So creating that level playing field and then enforcing it is going to help us develop as an industry.
Great, thank you. Senator Pisanski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think it's worth just noting that Measure 91 actually prohibits individuals from being able to do this process for these reasons that have been brought forward. And so if we're going to allow that through this process, it needs to be through a commercial operation that can have the regulations that they're seeking.
Correct, thank you. And I think you probably had something to do with that, Senator Pisanski, so I appreciate it. No more blown up houses. Okay, are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, our next topic is edibles, labeling, packaging, potency, and product purity. Try to say that one fast. And we will start off again with Mr. Burns. The mics are being fussy tonight, Tom, so just make sure it's close enough, but not too close.
It says here 12 inches, but apparently 12 inches doesn't mean 12 inches here.
Not tonight.
Not tonight. Joshua is handing out some props that I would think you ought to look at as we go through this. Edibles are just what they sound like. It is a product that is that you can consume orally, and that has in it THC and CBD of some level. They are generally made by taking a concentrate and mixing it with whatever you want to consume. There are a number of large policy questions that needs to be addressed about edibles, not the least of which is the whole questions of dosage. If you look closely at what is being handed out, many of these came from Colorado, and there are two of them that are local. You will see that on the back of the Colorado ones, they talk about how much product is in each serving of them and how long it takes for that serving to impact you. These are, they're all empty, I'm assured that. I've gone through them all, so there's...
We just checked. Whoa. You go, if your hands are shaking.
You can see on there some child warnings. You can see some dosage levels. You can see the THC levels on the products that are candies or cookies. You can see the what underlying ingredients are in there. All of these are things that need to be in labels. Colorado set the dosage label at 10 micrograms per dose, that and no more than 100 micrograms per product. And so, for example, the package that Representative Leininger just handed to Adam was a small square of chocolate that had more than 10 micrograms in it. The maker of this couldn't figure out how to carve up that square of chocolate, so that product is no longer available in Colorado. In others, you can see that the jars have things on it, that there are lozenges that have individual amounts. The labeling, potency, and safety need to be addressed. Is the underlying THC safe? That would be a result from a test that came as the product left the concentrate maker and was moved to the company that makes these. And the whole issue of child-proofing needs to be resolved. Some of these packages are very obviously child-resistant. Some of the packages are not. Some of the packages may be senior citizen-resistant and not be child-resistant. Those are questions that we'll have to wrestle with either from guidance from you or we can do by rule. Again, who makes these is a question that needs to be resolved. The license behind that, I've used the term commercial kitchen, and ODA can expand on that and address the issue that Senator Cruz just raised about the difference between a commercial kitchen and a retail outlet kitchen. So if you have any questions about specifically any of those products, I'll be happy to answer them for you, or if you have any other questions about what edibles are and what how they're used in the business, I will be happy to answer them.
Well, I just have to toot my own horn. I've actually learned something through this process, so it's actually milligrams, not micrograms.
Okay, I apologize.
As the newest person to this issue, I'm quite proud of myself. Questions of Mr. Burns? Thank you. And then your remarks in both cases will be submitted for OLIS, right?
Of course.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
It's because you did such a good job. Okay. Our next two witnesses are Lisa Hansen and Lauren Henderson from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Welcome.
Good evening. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Lauren Henderson, our Assistant Director. We're here to talk just a little bit about our food safety program, what we do in our food safety program, and how that may intersect in this area of edibles. And I'm going to let Lauren expand on that, and then we'll tag team on answers should there be questions.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening. Once again, for the record, my name is Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We thought it would be helpful just to give you a very quick overview of what our food safety program does. We inspect, the simplest way we talk about is we inspect every aspect of food safety except for restaurants. restaurants are done by the Oregon Health Authority, and that's how our two agencies split that. So we're in grocery stores, we're in bakeries, we're in meat establishments, we're in processing, and so forth. We have about 34 different licensing categories. Tom mentioned the commercial kitchen. That's a broader term that others might fit into. Commercial kitchen really is anybody that's producing something that looks like a kitchen and selling it commercially. That could be a domestic kitchen, someone who's producing food out of their own home. We have quite a few of those. It could be something on a much larger a scale, and then there's activities that are all in between that. We even have some commercial kitchens that I think even rent out space for folks to use that kitchen, and they kind of rent that because they don't have a facility of their own. In short, the mission of our food safety program is to help prevent the spread of foodborne illness. It's really that simple. We do that by enforcing the state sanitation laws, and there are several chapters, Oregon Revised Statutes, and I'm sorry I don't remember how many there are, that address those issues. We inspect the food establishments in Oregon. We have 34 inspectors who live throughout the state. They're the folks who work with our establishments and work side by side on some scheduled basis. We try to get in most establishments at least once a year if we can. And that represents approximately 7,000 different establishments, representing about 11,000 licenses. And so some establishments, like a grocery store, could have multiple licenses. They might have one for their deli, they might have one for their bakery if they have one in it, and then they have one for the rest of the store. So they would have potentially three different licenses. Some of the things that we look for when our staff are in those are some of the things that you would, common sense, sanitation, general sanitation, and how they handle those kinds of things. Building construction, do they have adequate washing stations and sinks, restrooms, and those kinds of things. Labeling of their products, and are they following those laws. Equipment, the condition of the equipment that they're using, and then basic controls. We always say at our department the hot food should be hot and the cold food should be cold, and the temperatures that go along with that. So that is a very quick overview of what we do. Senator Cruz, if I could answer, just respond to your question. We do have a memorandum of agreement with Oregon Health Authority for those establishments that have multiple activities that might have a health authority restaurant type activity, or might have an ODA in what we do. And we work together to try to figure out what is the predominant activity. Is it more on our side, which is a grocery store, or is it those things, a Safeway? It has a deli, but their predominant activity is a retail food establishment, so we would license them so they don't have to have two agencies doing those inspections. So we really try not to have multiple agencies in that regard. Certainly, now that we have OLCC as the primary on this, that will need to be discussed as we work through that. And of course, we're all working hard on that.
Okay, Representative Lanier.
Thank you for coming. This is so interesting because here we are trying to make sure that things are safe, but we know that there's a pretty comprehensive food safety system and distribution site safety system already in place because of, you know, food that has been sold, you know, for many, many years. And so I would love your take on, you feel like you can offer an opinion on the extent to which we need to create new systems and the extent to which, you know, your safeguards and Oregon Health Authority safeguards could transpose onto, you know, the Measure 91 medical world and do a pretty good job of providing the kinds of safeguards that we need. Where are their gaps?
So I think, Chair Leininger, that's a great question, and one that OLCC, Tom, and we have talked about a lot. I think where we're thinking right today is that we would design some system so that our staff, they know food safety. That's what they do every day. Our staff, ODA staff, they would still be looking for, in an establishment that is making edibles, that we would look to that establishment. I think one of the first questions we would ask that establishment is, do you have your license from OLCC to do that? And we would look for that. If they did, our staff would look to see that they had an ODA food safety license, and our staff would still do the inspection related to the food itself. Marijuana as an ingredient could still be regulated by the experts, in this case OLCC, for the marijuana ingredient itself. So how would that play out? If we had an illness that was attributed to a brownie, let's just say, and it was discovered through OHA, ODA, and possibly OLCC, that it was just a sanitation issue, I think that would still rest with ODA to follow up on that and figure out what happened there. If it was an issue in the fact that it wasn't, the THC content was higher than labeled, or there was an illness because of that, we would look to OLCC and their potential laws and regulations that you all are working on to solve that issue. That's how we've thought about it.
May I ask a follow-up?
Please follow up.
So that's really helpful, because I think that, you know, as Senator Cruz was noting, we're trying to be reasonable and prudent here, but we don't want to create lots of unnecessary systems or create a whole new universe of the same system housed in one place when we've got that system housed in other places. So thank you for your input.
Yeah.
Other questions? Did that answer your question, Senator Cruz?
Actually, I need to think about it, because what we've set up at this point, just on your jurisdiction, the health department jurisdiction, and whatever Tom's going to do at OLCC, we have a bifurcated system, I believe, at this point in time. The question is it in our best interest to do not have a bifurcated system, because we're dealing in some aspects with products that are slightly different. I would say that a marijuana brownie is slightly different than a banana, for example. So I guess that's, Madam Chair, just something we need to think about is there a more efficient way to have kind of a one-stop shopping for all of the sorts of inspections we're going to need inside this program?
Senator Prusansky.
What I'm hearing is maybe something a little different. It sounds to me that this isn't the, let's say, annual inspection. This, what I heard Lauren bringing up was, if there was an issue, who was going to basically take the lead in the investigation to make certain it doesn't happen again. So I can see where you would actually want to defer to someone who has more expertise. I was just trying to think if there's something in the way of food products or something that has food with alcohol in it has a similarity of how they would handle that, something, and I don't know if there is anything that would.
That was actually going to be my question, because when we were in Colorado, we found out that there is now marijuana infused wine. Mm. So where would something like that go?
Double whammy. And
and then some of these products are really, you know, it's hard to tell whether they're. It's hard to tell whether they are properly a kitchen thing. You know, how do you determine what constitutes a kitchen and what is outside the scope of something that your regulators would cover?
So, Chair Burdick, I think the short answer, and I'll take the last part first, is we have our staff go into the establishment and really figure out what are they doing? What are the activities? And that kind of leads us along the path for how they get licensed or what they're licensed under. Bakeries are easy. Those are their traditional cakes and cookies and, you know, pastries and things like that. It does get a little bit complex sometimes with all of the myriad of things that some of our establishments want to do. And so we have to be creative along with the establishments. They're also being creative in what we do. Sometimes they get multiple licenses or licensed in several categories to allow them to do multiple things. And then when our staff are there, they try to take care of the inspection for the whole facility at one time. They don't come back on a separate day because they have a separate license, because it takes their time out of the way of the business, too. As far as the example you gave with the wine, I think it was, the short answer is I'm not sure. I think there are some things that may have fallen through the cracks and some items that we really don't have a good handle on, and we'll go back and ask some of those questions about those kinds of things. I think for the most part on the alcohol side, it would be OLCC to a point. But.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, it can get complicated easy, and I have another example of that, because our kitchen is licensed by ODA. Because we make cakes and pies and cookies and all that stuff. We have located at our market a completely separate business. It's called the Dog House. They do hot dogs. Okay, they're licensed by the health department. Okay, they cannot bring their pots and pans into our kitchen to clean them. Because it's separate licenses, which meant that they had to go, because they don't have the kitchen, because it's just a little doghouse, they had to go in town and find somebody who is licensed by the health department and use their kitchen to clean things when they could walk 50 feet into my kitchen and stick them in my dishwasher, and it's not going to kill anybody, okay? I mean, these are the sorts of complications I'm hoping when we get this cross-jurisdictional stuff that we can find some way to smooth the system out. So,
well, if we do our job right, maybe you can just put some marijuana in your hot dogs and that will solve it.
Probably would increase sales, I suppose.
The munchie factory.
Yeah.
Senator Pazanski, I kind of intruded on your question there. Did you want to have any more follow-ups?
No, I'm trying to, hearing what Lauren was saying, it seems to me that you're going to have this process with OLCC. Someone wants to do whatever the product is, the edible they're going to make. They're going to get a license to be, I guess, a processor or a manufacturer, depending on what they're doing. And then if it's actually food that they're fixing as an edible, they're going to have the standalone license to operate that kitchen. And so it seems to me that they've been working as the two agencies, sounds like pretty well together, understanding that we're going to control the kitchen and everything that goes on there. Just because marijuana is one of the ingredients there, it doesn't kick it over to OLCC to be doing something else unless there's an issue with that particular ingredient. That's at least what I'm taking
away
from
that's it.
This at this point. So I guess then the other part of what Senator Cruz brought up is this going to be, let's say, package-type food that would be going home like you'd get from the supermarket, or if it was going to be a restaurant that had infused food, which I'm not even sure that would even be allowed to actually serve, because that is something I think 91 was attempting to address, that you wouldn't be able to consume within a public area, and it seems like a restaurant would be out of the question. So that might take care of the health issue.
Just throwing up some red flags, Madam Chair.
Madam
Chair, we've talked about keeping this as streamlined and as the less agencies that are involved, the less the expense is going to be and all that stuff. So,
and I think you really seriously do raise a good point, because if this program is going to be successful, keeping in mind that we're competing with some outside forces there, we have to have a competitive market, and part of being a competitive market is not overtaxing and overregulating. So I think your point was well made. Other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. We're just racing right along here. Thank you very much. Now we have Space Cake Dave McNichol, Anthony Taylor.
Questions that we have answers.
I think we'll do those two together and then take the last two. You get the award for the most fun name.
Oh, well, thank you.
In the panel tonight.
Point that out.
Dave McNichols. Why don't you start, Dave?
Okay. Hello, senators and representatives. Thank you for taking the time and inviting me to speak today. My name is David Michael McNichol. I have been producing marijuana-infused edibles for the past 8 years in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program and the Oregon Medical Marijuana Dispensary Program. I'll keep my presentation brief to allow for as much time for specific questions as possible. Effective legislation in regards to edibles is essential for proper implementation of Measure 91. 45% of Colorado's first-year recreational sales were from edibles. These products need to be produced in properly licensed commercial kitchens with strict regulations and oversight from the state. If this is not done, unregulated, non-tested, at-home edibles will continue to be made without any dosing suggestions or child safety packaging. Edibles are a safer, non-combustible form of ingesting marijuana, which does not require lighting a substance on fire and breathing it through the lungs. When talking about public safety, it goes without saying that providing alternative forms of consumption that do not require smoking would be necessary. When I first met with the state senator a few weeks ago, the first thing the senator said to me, and I could see the genuine concern on the senator's face, they asked, how many edibles would a person have to ingest to receive a lethal dose? The direct answer to this question is it is not possible in any way, shape, or form to consume enough marijuana to achieve a lethal dose. I did not have any scientific facts to respond with at that time, so I looked some up. There has not been a single proven documented cannabis-induced fatality recorded in any medical database throughout history. In order to induce death, a user would need to consume 20,000 times as much marijuana as in one marijuana cigarette. That is roughly 1,500 pounds of marijuana in a 15-minute period. If you were trying to do this eating edibles, you would die from an overdose of salt at 3,000 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, or sugar at 1,100 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, before ever coming close to the marijuana threshold. I'm just going to say that again. You would die from an overdose of salt or sugar before ever coming close to the threshold for marijuana. There is a public misconception that somehow edibles are more powerful or a more dangerous form of marijuana. The key to safely using marijuana in edible form is in proper dosaging. Colorado recently implemented a 10 milligram maximum per serving policy and have had tremendous success with their public safety Try 5 campaign, in which they encourage first-time edible users to take it slow and try 5. Adopting similar THC maximum milligram caps and public education campaigns, combined with the already in place requirements for child safety packaging under ORS 475-346, are a solid framework to begin with. In closing, we have two solid examples that have come before us, Washington and Colorado. We can utilize and improve upon policies that have worked and learn from and revise upon policies that did not. Edibles are just as important to Measure 91 as the dried flowers they are made from. As a proud OMMP patient and a proud Oregon business owner, I know that we can show this country and the world just how proud they can be of Oregon and our ability to create sound public policy. Thank you for your time.
And thank you. Anthony?
Co-Chairs Burdick and Leninger, thank you for the opportunity to once again provide testimony before this committee. Again, for the record, my name is Anthony Taylor. I am appearing before the committee today as a founding partner of Canyon 6 Industries, DBA of Funsom Farms, LLC, headquartered in Williams, Oregon. We offer cannabis-infused products in the form of medicated cookies and topical products. It's hard to know where to begin with this, in a sense. There's such a wide variety of products available on today's market, ranging from the well-known brownie to the more nuanced baked goods, candies, and drinks. It is also important, I think, to make the distinction between cannabis-infused products for medical use and for recreational use. The dynamic here is most patients expect to feel something from ingesting a cannabis-infused product, which is kind of the standard benchmark for most medications. A diabetic certainly feels the effects of insulin, Someone with high blood pressure can certainly tell the difference if they've missed taking their medication for a day or two. And someone taking opioids for pain can definitely tell when they're kicking in. It's the same with cannabis products, but as with any medication designed to mitigate chronic symptoms, after a time you accept that it's working, whether you feel it or not. Patients want a product that is consistent, sometimes conditions specific, such as high CBD products, and not overpowering. Of course, recreational users seek a more intense, longer-lasting effect. Thank you. The infamous marijuana brownie comes to mind. For most people, lesser steeped in the nuances of cannabis medicine. So just to kind of set the stage, I'd like to provide the committee with the rules for packaging, labeling, and testing of cannabis-infused products as set forth in the administrative rules under the dispensary program. And these are them. I start with the definition of batch because in recent revisions to the rules, they added the use of a single strain in their definition of a batch. This is problematic for medical producers, not so much if you're producing a strain-specific batch, but if you're using a homogeneous blend of plant materials to process into a concentrate, it can be problematic because it requires you to cite a strain when you take your product to the dispensary. So you got to kind of pull something out of the air if you've used that homogeneous blend. Finished product means that that's what medibles are considered under the rules, not limited to edible products, ointments, concentrates, and tinctures. Usable marijuana has a meaning given in ORS 472302 and includes finished products. I mention this only because it's problematic because an edible is considered a finished product, it's subject to the 24-ounce limit. This is problematic for transporting your product to your facilities. It's also problematic in having too much for the type of product we produce. One batch puts us at about 743 grams, which is about 8 ounces. I'm sorry. it's about 27 ounces, so we're over the limit. This is what's required for labeling. The section B here applies to the finished products. You're required to have your THC and your CBD potency on it. The weight or volume of usable marijuana in the finished product in grams, milligrams, or milliliters. The testing batch number and the date it was tested, who performed that test, and a warning label in accordance with Section 2 of this rule, which requires you to have in bold capital letters in a font size that's larger than anything else on the label, warning medicinal product, keep out of the reach of children. further, regarding the packaging, for purposes of this rule, of course, child-resistant safety packaging, this is what they're requiring. They also define container being a sealed, hard, or soft body receptacle with a THC-infused product is placed prior to being transferred. Has to be packaged in a manner not attractive to minors. This is a little tricky, especially when it comes to cookies. Cookies are attractive to everybody. So we have to, you know, work through the dynamics of that requirement. And then, of course, the facility can't transfer any THC-infused products unless it's in child safety packaging and packaged in a manner not attractive to children, and cannot be transferred in any container that's brightly colored or in the shape of any animal or other commercially recognized toy or candy. This just slide is really briefly about testing. All finished products are required to be tested. Prior to the adoption of this rule, just recently in the last revision of the rules for the dispensaries were required to test everything that came in. Since the vendors or manufacturers are required to label their products for THC and CBD, they have to test it. So this rule was adopted to enable facilities to accept those test results from the vendor that's putting packaged products into the system. So Canyon 6 Industry is a startup company that over the last 18 months has been trying to deal with the rules the packaging, the labeling, the dosing. And what we are trying to do is develop a product that can be used by patients to mitigate their symptoms while still allowing them to conduct day-to-day activities without impairment, including going to work, caring for children or other family members, or safely operating a motor vehicle or other industrial machinery and equipment. The genesis of our products came from the desire to use cannabis on a regular basis while conducting these day-to-day activities rather than heavy doses of opioid medications. We also were concerned about providing a product for patients that do not want to smoke or for patients in hospitals and care facilities where smoking is prohibited. Perhaps the most important question we had to answer in this process what's a standard dose for a human? And most of the data suggests that a dose of about 15 milligrams is an appropriate dose for a single individual seeking to maintain a certain level of cannabis in their system for chronic conditions without impairment. As was mentioned earlier, Colorado has recently adopted a single dose to be 10 milligrams. As with all medications, the effect wore off, and so it was determined that a 15 milligram dose could be taken every 6 to 8 hours without a noticeable impairment. So even among regular patients, this has taken some educating about the efficacy of a low-dose medication versus a larger dose is typically associated with these products. And there is a distinct difference between medicating and baking. And it is a distinction often confused even by our own community. And it's a distinction we've had to train dispensaries to explain to their patients that, look, you may not feel this when you ingest it, but rest assured that the amount of THC in this product will titrate your levels to mitigate your symptoms. So the next question we had to ask ourselves was to how to safely package our product and establish guidelines for its use. How many doses per package, recommended use, and of course packaging in a manner that would ensure public safety and the risks and reduce the risk of accessibility by children. So here's what we started with 18 months ago. Two cookies in a simple plastic bag, a 4x4 bag. This was before dispensaries were codified. Then we went to this. Simple package, a little bit of a label. Then we went to this, which is the opaque package, a bigger label, including most of the stuff that is required. And then finally, this is the product that we're going to be using from here forward. This product, as you can see by the little indentations in the top, is how you open it. And the line in the middle is a Ziploc sealable part so that you can have multiple doses in it.
Standard packaging.
So everybody's pretty much talked about the integration of licensing and how the OHA and the Department of Ag and how the OLCC will address all these issues. So I'm just going to skip all that stuff. Although, you know, these are the rules that apply. The ORS 616 is what guides the Department of Agriculture and the Oregon Health Authority in their exercising of the duties required. And also in 625, we also find, you know, the licensing required to operate bakeries and that sort of thing. And all that licensing, of course, falls under, you know, with the domestic home kitchens and the larger commercial kitchens. It's all taken care of by those folks. So I'm just going to let what's been said sit. So I did bring some show and tell. I know that you folks already received a couple of items regarding packaging. But for those of you that have never been in a dispensary, this is kind of what you see when you walk in. These are some of the packagings available through like 420 packaging, and that is the typical clamshell packaging that a lot of people put their medibles in, as is evidenced by this package. But I would add that those are non-compliant packaging. They are not opaque. They have to be opaque. And they have to be child safety proof. And so when you're talking about putting a cookie or something of that nature in, you can go with one of these products, which is a, you know, one of those kind of tops, and you're able to put cookies or baked goods of anything like that, and they come in all kinds of different shapes and sizes. Here's a standard pop top, which is kind of tricky for kids to figure out, but I bet my 4-year-old could have done that. It's also non-compliant. It's not opaque. It's translucent. It's not opaque. But, you know, it does serve to be able to put small products in and get it out the door. And I know that a lot of the dispensaries are using a product like this, which, again, is child-resistant and also able to be flipped over like most medical containers so that us older folks can, you know, get it open. So that's what's available as far as containers. And, again, anything that's not opaque is not compliant with Oregon law. So let me just jump into a couple of the other products, and so you folks can get an idea of the labeling. This is a bar called Tiger Butter Chocolates. This is what it looks like. It's full of chocolate. It's full of 350 micrograms or milligrams of chocolate. That's a heck of a dosage.
Of marijuana, of THC, you mean?
Yes, ma'am, of THC. You can see this number 3 indicates that it should only be used by people with a high tolerance, patients with high tolerance. I'm kind of nervous about a bar that has, you know, like that has 350 milligrams when, you know, that's like, what is that, 20 times the recommended dose of 15 milligrams? So these are the kind of things that, you know, I'm sure that this committee will address and that the OLCC will address. There are a lot of different products on the market like that. And some of them are individual packages that just contain individual, you know, just one bite pieces. But again, they're, you know, this is like a 100 milligram piece of edibles. And again, worrisome for most people.
But those are compliant, the ones you just showed?
These packages are compliant simply because they're a single dose package, so they don't have to have the Ziploc. You know, no child is going to be able to get into that. Part of the dynamics of this childproof thing is, you know, it's hard to control what the parents are doing, so it needs to be in a package that children can't get into it when it leaves the dispensary. What happens when it gets inside the home, we really have no control over, other than those laws that pertain to children and negligent parents. And so what happens typically, especially when you have something like this, is they go in a package like this, which is a pinch to open package that gets you into it. Then the Ziploc opens it up. These are placed inside the bag, and then the bag is sealed, and the patient leaves with this bag. So there's nothing really on it. There's no cartoons or anything of that nature, and this is what a lot of the dispensaries are using to put their products in as they leave. So one other thing here is this bag. This is the infamous gummies. It's not actually the product gummies, but this is a gummy bear. This is not a cannabis-infused product. This came out of this jar. Vitamins for children. Which, if a child got a hold of this jar and could get into its contents and ate that whole thing, they would certainly be taken to the hospital for some kind of vitamin overdose. It would certainly make them sick. And but the industry for vitamins has moved to gummies. It seems to be easier to infuse a gummy than a lozenge. And speaking of lozenges, there are narcotics like fentanyl that are available in what they call lozenge on a stick for people to, you know, medicate themselves with. This, I want to call attention to, this is a Chiba Chew. I apologize for using the brand names, but there it is. This is a four-dose package. Wow. So this goes back to what was mentioned before about this people trying to get a small enough thing for just 10 milligrams and be in a single dose. Maybe that will require the industry to move towards blister packaging. I don't know, but this is, I think, 75 milligrams in here.
Wow.
In this one package. And it's not very childproof. Now, again, this is something that would not go out of the dispensary like this. It would go into a bag. So that's kind of an overview of what they're seeing in the dispensaries right now. But I would like to just go to one last thing here on packaging. This is a package of Macaroon Crunch by Nature's Path. It's organic. And it goes to the part of packaging and labeling that the medical marijuana community is not taking into account right now. And that's the rules required by the Department of Ag and all the packaging rules that go along with making a product that gets put on the store shelves to be consumed by the everyday Oregonians. It requires, and I can't imagine that it wouldn't also apply to these packages, it requires nutritional facts. It requires that you disclose how much vitamin A, C, calcium, and iron are in the package. It requires you to list the ingredients in the order of the most in the package. So if you have 2 cups of flour, 1 cup of sugar, 1/2 cup of molasses, that's how it goes, flour, sugar, molasses, then your spices. And you also have to put a notice on there that it may have been produced in a facility that also uses nuts, soy, those kind of allergens. And in the case of a package that you have are making a claim that it will help you get better, you have to have an FDA disclaimer, which I believe is right there. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. So all of these things are required to be on a package in the state of Oregon, and the people that are producing these types of products are inspected by the Oregon Department of Ag and also the FDA, and they can come in at any time. There's wild kind of rules that apply. For instance, if you know, a processing plant like this receives a shipment of flour, and they've got a pallet of flour on the truck, but in the front they've got another pallet and it's got lacquer thinner on that pallet, they have to refuse the delivery of the flour because they're two products that are not supposed to be combined. So all these sorts of small rules, big rules that apply to normal manufacturing of these types of products that Oregonians are going to eat, are kind of being ignored at this point by the medical manufacturers.
Your point is they're not complying with these requirements?
That's correct. Okay. Now, I'm not, as this committee may know, not one to advocate for a lot of rules and regulations, but I can't see any reason why these rules and regulations wouldn't also apply to the manufacturing of these medibles. I don't want the liability, of somebody ingesting one of my products and coming back after me because they overdosed or they drove their car into a tree or whatever might happen. So I would advocate that these rules, you know, are integrated into dealing with medibles. I certainly can't imagine that the OLCC would not would allow, you know, a medible of this nature, even though it's compliant with the rules of the dispensaries, to be sold in their stores.
Because?
Well, they're not compliant.
Because it's...
And they're not manufactured in a licensed facility.
Okay.
That's probably the main part, is that, you know, you have to have a license to manufacture these things, and with that comes the inspections and the regulations and all the rules.
Okay. Are you ready for questions?
Really quick, let me wrap up, and I would be ready for questions. So One thing that I would like to point out, because I know this committee is going to, and as well as the OLCC, is going to have to deal with the issue of concentrates. Concentrates are the end game for medible manufacturers. I want to be able to go to the bakery supply store and buy a gallon of concentrate that's 80% THC, so that when I'm mixing my batch of 10,000 cookies, I can add a quarter cup of concentrate, and I'm done. I'm good. I know that the product that I manufacture is going to come out with, in the right weight with the right amount of THC in it. And so we need to keep that in mind as we deal with concentrates. So I guess in closing, especially when it comes to medibles, I just would offer that ultimately, as with all drugs, the parents are responsible to ensure that their children and others don't have access to these medications. Oregon has laws that apply to parents that are negligent in these responsibilities, and negligence with cannabis medication should be no different. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson, you had a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. To Anthony. Anthony, wanted to ask you about a public figure not long back. I wish I'd paid attention to it, but a woman who supposedly was some public figure who ate a brownie in Colorado and described some long, strange trip she was on at the conclusion of it. Can you give us, and I know this is speculation, but of the things that you've shown us here tonight, can you give us an idea of what that person might have ingested, or give us an idea of how many milligrams over what amount of time? I know that has to...
One of these bars right here.
Really?
Co-chairs... Representative Wilson, this is the sort of thing that can get somebody in trouble.
I see. Okay.
And Maureen Dowd, I believe, is the person that you were referring to, and she knew better, frankly. but it is also the responsibility, I think, of the dispensaries or the recreational shops to make sure that people know what they're doing and what kind of thing they're putting in their system. So it's a tricky one. I know some manufacturers here in Oregon manufacture a bar like this, and it's scored so that, you know, a single dosage is easily determined.
Yeah, okay.
And that's how they address that.
Appreciate that. Could I respond to that
as
well?
Yes,
please. Yes, I know that every person's physiology is completely different, and everyone's metabolism is completely different. And so the same 15 milligrams will affect 20 different people 20 different ways. Some people have very high tolerances naturally, and some people have very low tolerances. So it's very difficult to determine what kind of reaction a person's body is going to have until they try it, which is why the Try 5 campaign is so effective, so you can build up.
Thanks.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Anthony, the packages from Colorado all seem to have like a activation time on them, 20-minute activation time on this, for instance. Is that something you would recommend for products packaged in Oregon as well?
Yes, we do put that on our packaging as well. It is helpful for the people that don't have any experience with this. And again, it's implicit, I think, upon the dispensaries to make sure that people are aware of how long it takes to kick in. You've got to give this some time. All my patients, I say, look, you want to start slow. The Start 5?
Try 5, yeah.
Try 5. You want to start slow and give it an hour or two, and then, you know, it's like taking Vicodin in a sense. It's like, you know, 5 milligrams wouldn't have much effect on somebody that regularly uses it, but on somebody that just taken it because they had a tooth extracted, it might put them down on the couch for the evening. So,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Leininger.
Thanks. That was really helpful,
which is
why I photographed it. So, thank you both for presenting, and everyone who's presented today. What I am taking away from your presentation, Mr. Taylor, is that there are some good aspects to the existing medical program packaging and labeling requirements, like the opacity, and maybe there's a child-resistant element. It can't look like an animal or a toy. But that we, and the keep away from kids language, but we might want to look at adding, you know, maybe across the domains some sort of level of intensity per serving size, be it 10 milligrams or 15, something that's predictable so that people don't kind of step into something. And activation time, if it's not currently required. Are there other, and the manufacturers should comply with the existing rules that probably apply anyway, but maybe haven't been incorporated into packaging. Is that an accurate interpretation of what you're saying, or is there a different summary that would make more sense to you?
Well, Madam Co-Chair, I really do believe it's helpful to have a dosing information on the package. For instance, our packaging says recommended dosage, one cookie, and give it some time. And once you become comfortable with that, if you're going to choose to use it on a continuing basis, once you become comfortable with that, then you know what to expect. And so these types of dosage recommendations and additional warnings, I know that when you get a prescription filled for Vicodin or OxyContin, there's four different warnings: do not operate machinery, don't use with alcohol, all that sort of stuff. It makes sense, although, you know, when you have a smaller package, it makes it harder to get all that information onto it, and so then you have to go to a blister pack sort of presentation where, you know, you have a small cookie, but you have a big box for it so that you can get all that information on it. It's a public health and safety issue that I think that we really seriously need to address and work through.
Okay. Questions?
Yeah, I mean, most of the warnings and all that. I mean, that's federal. The question is, because we're dealing with a Schedule One, do we still have to comply with all the federal regs? We do. I mean, that's a good question. Although that would be one more way to get in trouble. But Anthony, you were talking about. What confused me was you said if you had flour and turpentine on the same truck, and I'm trying to think of what wholesaler are you buying from?
Well,
I mean, most food safety things, I mean, we get our supplies from Cisco Systems, and that's all they do. I mean, you're mixing some things that I don't think normally get mixed, aren't you?
Well, normally they don't get mixed, and it is typically an isolated incident, but when you're using truckers that are, you know, backhauling or something like that, that's where you might run into a situation like that.
Thank you. This chocolate bar really got my attention, and the little tiny package with the huge amount of THC got my attention. This seems like it's excessive even for the medical market. Do you agree with that? That we ought to put some sideboards into the production? I guess it was the smallest one that really got my attention with a lot of THC in it.
Well, Madam Chair, I do think that it is a concern. Would you restate your question for me, please?
Well, I mean, just do you think we ought to put some sideboards on the maximum dose you can have in anything that's within the same package?
I think, for the most part, that's correct. There are some patients that do require a heavier dose of cannabis to mitigate their symptoms. But I think initially some sideboards are warranted.
But wouldn't it make sense for that population to maybe get two chocolate bars that were, you know, of a certain dosage rather than take the risk?
Madam Chair, I believe so.
Okay, thank you. Do you have comments?
I mean, I have requests for 1,000 milligram items, and if you were to do that, you'd have to eat 3 or 4 or 5 chocolate bars, you know, in the morning, you know, just to get going. And for the medical market and the recreational market are completely different. The recreational market has to have very strict dosaging requirements because they're using it as medicine. The medical side is a lot different.
Thank you.
Yeah, and just following up, that's exactly what I was going to point out, is that's one of the reasons why we need to maintain the medical So it is separate and distinct. Those individuals have gone through some type of understanding. The people that they're getting product from are counseling them and helping them understand what they're doing and their dosage. And but at the same time, when you look at the retail, I look at that and I'm wondering, should we have that available on a retail level? I can understand a value a bar when you get more servings in one bar, but maybe for the retail side, we say one single dose, and whatever that number is going to be, 10 milligrams, 15 milligrams, whatever, I don't know what that's going to be. That's the size that we allow for that selling. But it does get back to a point that Anthony also says, is at the same time, with the warnings and notices that we need to have, there's going to be potentially excess packaging just to make certain that you get that there. But I really think this is a distinction and a bright line, as we've heard, that why we need to maintain the medical and allow those who are in the medical program to continue what they're doing, because they have already gone through this process, they've been educated, and it seems kind of wacky you having them eat five chocolate bars to get to their dose in the morning, but not allow that for retail sale.
Colorado, they did the 10 milligram per serving, but the maximum per package is 100 milligrams.
Okay, yeah, I don't understand that at this point. Thank you for the clarification. But, yeah, those are the type of things that either, I don't know if we as a committee are doing or if we're going to be letting OLCC do. But
well, and I think this is a good, because part of what we're trying to do is parse out what, and you and I talked about it, Dave, when you came to my office, is, you know, what do we need to do differently in the recreational market than we do in the medical market? And I think that's one of the things we'll be discussing. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, just an aside, I thought your question about the chocolate bar related more to your inability to resist the chocolate than it had to do with the infusion part of the project.
Yeah, don't get personal.
Okay. I do have a question. If in the case of that chocolate bar, which has a content, a cannabis content, which requires or at least motivates you to put a 3 on it, which shows that it's heavily infused. is there any way for a person to determine that that is an infused product if it were removed from the packaging and repackaged?
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Farioli, there has been a lot of discussion about that. And if the size is adequate to adopt a scoring method, very much probably should adopt those sorts of rules. But it gets tricky when you have just a small product. So you would have to incorporate that into the labeling and the packaging.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to follow up. I guess I'm looking at a different, if the packaging is separated from the product, is there a way for a third party to determine that the product is an infused product or not?
Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Farioli, the short answer is no. Now, some of them, as I said, are scored so that you can break them into individual pieces, but standalone bar? Nope. Standalone cookie? Nope. Now maybe we implement some rule that requires us to implant an M on the face of the cookie. But it is a concern.
Or on each little chocolate-coated piece of candy. You know. Now somebody's already thought of that. I appreciate any direction you could give us in helping people determine if the product got separated from the package, just on, would there be a visual cue? Would there be any kind of indices that would allow people to say, oh, that's something I should keep out of reach of children, or maybe put in a controlled environment? Because there it is. It's got this indicator, whatever that is. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Wanted to ask the panel about the effectiveness of scoring. I think we've all tried to break a chocolate bar along the score before, and sometimes it's accurate, sometimes not. But for the sake of this argument, let's talk about it being reasonably accurate and breaking the way it's supposed to. Is that a fairly accurate way of dosing?
I don't feel that it's the best way when you can have, you can make the product a lower dosage product. Instead of having a chocolate bar broken up into 12 pieces, why not have 12 little pieces of chocolate? So I don't see the scoring as being effective. I see that people will ignore the scoring and just eat the entire thing anyway.
That's, it's the chocolate.
What happens?
It's the chocolate. It's very addictive.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been very helpful. Thank you. Okay, our last panel tonight is Ellen Ford and Gene Wilson to talk about infused topicals.
No, not even.
Okay. I'm sorry. If we can get our seating correct here. Good evening. I am Ellen Ford, and our company is Clear Creek Botanicals, and we are here tonight to represent the Oregon Infused Topical Association.
And I am Jean Wilson. I am Ellen's business partner. Madam Chair, really appreciate, and committee members, really appreciate the opportunity to come here tonight and present to you. Thank you.
Topical products are kind of the stepsister of the marijuana industry because we take a product that gets you high and we make it into something that doesn't. Our products include hand lotion, body lotion, facial lotion, healing oils, and salves. There's two reasons why our products don't get you high. First of all, they are applied topically, just like any other health and beauty product. The skin is a marvelous container for our body. It only lets a certain amount of things through it. So, for instance, water molecules are too big to pass through our skin. And topical products, most lotions run 60 to 90% water. The second reason why our products don't get you high, is because of the small amount of THC in the products. Each member of our association has tested their products in accordance to the medical marijuana laws. And we found that after we're done processing our products, the THC in them ranges from 0.3% to 0.6%, far less than the 1.5% that is determined by the National Institutes of Health for smoked marijuana to get you high. So they're applied topically, and the amount of THC is pretty much negligible in them. Excuse me. What we are proposing to do is to extend the distribution system for topical marijuana products outside of the OLCC network of stores. We feel that to limit sales to the OLCC stores would be a disservice to both Oregonians and to the state of Oregon. So you're thinking, wow, that's a pretty strong statement that we just made. How would it be a disservice to Oregonians? We know of many people who are not familiar with marijuana products, who find the word marijuana to be somewhat daunting. They would never think of going to a marijuana store for any reason. There's also a stigma with the word marijuana. We prefer to use the word cannabis. But if somebody saw somebody going into a marijuana store, their boss, a church coworker, a fellow church member, it could be embarrassing to them. Even though Gene and I have gone to dispensaries for years, I have to say the first time I entered a dispensary, which are marvelous places, I'm so glad we have them, I was a little apprehensive. I was like, oh, what is this going to be like? You know, are they going to be nice to me? They were absolutely delightful, and they explained the products quite well. But I understand if that is just too much of a barrier to entry for people. There's also going to be limited shelf space in the OLCC stores. So competing for shelf space with products that if the main target audience is coming in to get products to get high, the stores are not going to carry as much of our products. So what we are proposing is to expand the sales distribution for topical products outside of the OLCC to alternative medical clinics, such as the chiropractic's office, naturopath, massage therapist, to grocery stores, to health food stores, to farmers markets, perhaps even in-home parties, much like Avon. We have a saying we like to say, beauty goes to pot. So we'll be the beauty goes to pot gals. So how would this be a disservice to the state of Oregon? I understand, because this is work that I did in the corporate marketplace, that finding new markets and opportunities for economic development are tough to find. And if you'll excuse my pun, this is a homegrown opportunity. Last year, if I extrapolated all of the figures correctly, Avon sold about $10 million worth of product here in Oregon. The product was not manufactured in Oregon. It was not processed in Oregon. It was not packaged in Oregon. And all of that would transpire here with local ingredients. So I feel that it is a huge opportunity for grassroots cottage industry to grow in Oregon, which then would bring revenue. We would be very happy as topical makers to comply with all the regulations in regards to growing the cannabis. We would register just like everyone else, every other grower would, or we would purchase from a registered grower. As for processing, currently Gene and I use a friend's commercial kitchen simply because we wanted to have the assurance that we had everything very clean for our products. But if you look at the lotion industry throughout Oregon, they are under FDA regulation, and they are not required, frankly, to do much of any testing. They have labeling requirements, which we will comply with. But I'm not sure that having a commercial kitchen isn't overboard. Because we will, at the end of the process, after processing, test for THC, for mold, for pesticides, heavy metals, just the same as everyone in the industry does. But what we're asking is, because our products don't get you high, once we're done with the processing, to let us sell throughout the state in a variety of different distribution channels. Let's see. In conclusion, I'd just kind of like to wrap it up that infused topical products containing less than 1% THC cannot get you high, yet they may offer therapeutic relief for a variety of illnesses while providing economic development opportunity throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very interesting endeavor you're involved in.
Thank you.
Senator Pruzanski.
Thank you. And either for Ellen or for Gene, I'm really looking at your panel, or at your pamphlet here, and it talks about the CBDs. And can you tell us what your topicals, what is the CBD percentage that's in those lotions?
Would you like to address that? Okay. Thank you for your question. The CBDs depend upon what plant material we use to create the products. It can run from nothing up to 1 or 2%. And the reason that our products get diluted down so much is because we infuse oil, and we use oil as a basis to make all of our products. But then we add a lot of other things to the oil. We add water to the oil, we add wax, we add vitamin E, things of that nature. So what Gene and I have been doing, so I can only speak to that, is we have been using half THC dry product and half CBD product. So our when we start out, the THC in our dry product is about 18%, and the CBDs have tested out at about 13%. When we're done making the product, the THC is about 0.4%, and the CBD is usually about 0.8 to 1%.
Okay. Follow up. So there's other, say, individuals making lotions and stuff. They're using industrial hemp and seed there, and of course we know that that has little to no THC.
Right.
The attributes for it compared to what you're putting out. I'm just trying to figure out: is there one that would be considered better than the other for the lotions?
Definitely. In our white paper, we have a page on why hemp is not a good substitute. The combination of THC and CBDs from the marijuana plants has much greater healing capabilities than the CBDs in the hemp. Hemp has been developed for fiber, primarily. And so the CBDs in there are of a different quality.
Okay, thank you.
I hope that answered your question.
You have a question?
I do. Well, I think this is tremendously interesting. And, I think there are some, factually, I don't know, that these lotions don't get you high. But if it were the case that they didn't, and this is kind of the kombucha of lotion, then maybe there is a scenario in which it warrants a lighter touch in our ability to distribute it. I love the idea that you're seizing on an opportunity for us to grow a new product with locally sourced ingredients and sell it. And, we've got to make sure that we're creating a fair playing field for people who are using cannabis as an ingredient across the spectrum. But I think you raise a really interesting question about whether your product has such a negligible amount of THC in it that it warrants a somewhat different approach. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Thank you.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I too am intrigued by being able to produce this in Oregon and sell it to Oregonians. Have you consulted with an attorney in regard to at our first committee hearing? We heard the various memos that have been put out by the Department of Justice in terms of what they would allow states to do in regard to the regulation of marijuana and marijuana products. Have you consulted with an attorney at all how this might or might not fit in with the federal guidelines from DOJ?
Yes, we have. In fact, we have a business partner in California who is doing the same thing, only she is selling through the dispensary system. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we don't trade products, we trade recipes. And the attorney, Robert Raich, has been to the Supreme Court twice for marijuana issues, and he is our attorney. And we said, we decarboxylate the product, so you couldn't get high from it unless you utilized some process to wash the THC off, which is what we do. We just soak it in oil. Mm. That's all we do. It's just like infusing olive oil with basil. As we laid out our proposition to him, he said, "Does it have marijuana in it?" And we said, "Yes." And he said, "Then no, you can't take it over state lines. No, you cannot sell it outside of your state. And within your state, you need to comply with the laws of your state." So thank you for your question.
Thank you.
That does raise an interesting issue, because we have a restriction against using it in public. And so if you had somebody bring their hand lotion to use after they wash their hands, then it's an interesting issue.
Right.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for bringing a new and intriguing issue to us, and thank you to all the panelists who participated tonight. We learned a lot, as we have been at every meeting. Representative Leininger, do you want to give a sneak preview of our next meeting?
So the next meeting we are going to have on Monday, we're going to be talking about environmental land use and siting issues related to marijuana. And it's going to be a great meeting. And then we're going to have one more the following meeting for informational sessions. And then I think we're going to be getting ready to transition to a new chapter in the life of the committee. So super exciting. We look forward to seeing you on Monday. We look forward to seeing you on Monday. Exciting.